Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How do we introduce this?
Last week it just started.
Oh yeah. So it's Wednesday evening.
Yes, it's only been a couple of days since we last talked.
A few days, I think.
Okay. I mean, you'd no need to get pedantic about it.
Well, otherwise, a couple of days sounds like we're sort of cheating the listeners, and we're sort of recording like two in a week and
It's been 3 days.
When we arranged this date, I wasn't quite aware it was going to be the day of the. Well, I was aware of the day of the Autumn Statement, but it's the Autumn Statement.
Yes. How was that for you? Were you there?
I was there. I've got so much to say about this.
Oh, go on then.
Okay, so I'm slightly sort of overflowing with anecdotary, actually. So I will come to back to the Jeremy Hunt one. But so I sat in a front room somewhere in 1996, 27 years ago. I thought it was 17 years ago when I was thinking about this on Tuesday, and I realized it was 27 years ago, for Ken Clark's last budget.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And it leaked the night before. To the Daily Mirror, the whole of the budget leaked the night before. Not
oh, wow.
A part of it, but the whole of it leaked. And I've talked to Nick McPherson, who was a permanent secretary at the Treasury, but was at this point the sort of main civil servant in his private, running his private office to Ken Clark. And basically, this is an incredible Ken Clark story. So the budget leaks, it's 5 or 6 o'clock. Everybody in the Treasury goes absolutely nuts. They get a call from the Daily Mirror saying, we've got the whole budget. Everybody in the Treasury is beside themselves. This is the whole thing leaking. Lawyers, people running around, etc. Ken Clark, I'm off to Gandhi's, the Indian restaurant. You guys sort it out. And it was sorted out. I mean, no mobile phone.
Absolutely no problem with delegation.
I'm off to Gandhi's. You guys sort it out. I mean, it's just the guy, he's got a certain sort of, I don't know, I'm not sure that would have been Gordon's reaction or mine, for that matter.
Well, I enjoyed that a lot, and I always enjoy when you reveal yourself as the Mike Yarwood of Westminster.
But I remember sitting with the late Philip Gould, you know, Philip Gould, who was Tony Blair's, well, pollster strategist. And Philip and I used to drive sometimes in my car to different places in London to go and do these focus groups. And I would go from Gordon's office, and obviously Philip was there from Tony's office. I think I remember once my car, which is a very old car, stopped in the middle of the North Circular or something, and green slime started coming. It wasn't that day.
What?
Green slime started coming out of it, and Philip was like, okay, I'll see you later, alligator. Anyway, we made, and it wasn't the green slime day, but there we were. And I think it was just, Philip wanted real time sort of response to the budget.
Man.
But it was totally artificial because who sits there and watches such as a budget speech?
Well, I know. So I didn't know that you'd been along to focus groups.
Is that a weird
experience? So are you behind, behind the one-way mirror?
In those days, there was no one-way mirrors, two-way mirrors, or one-way mirrors. You'd basically just be with somebody's front room. And Philip used to say, hello, I'm Philip, and I do these for a living around the country and around the world. And then he'd go around and talk to people. It was actually very good at putting people at their ease.
I always think the flaw with focus groups, though, is that they're not indicative of what people think. They're indicative of what the type of person who would be in a focus group thinks. Because most people have never been in a focus group and probably wouldn't do it for the 30 quid Marks and Spencer's gift voucher and slice of pizza that they get.
I'm not sure there was a 30 quid Marks.
Well, whatever. So it's a self-selecting group of people anyway.
Yeah, okay, well, that's true.
And then I always think if I was on a jury and there was somebody like with a real alpha, loud personality saying a bunch of stuff that I disagreed with, I'd just shrink into myself because I want to avoid confrontation. And I wonder if that's a flaw of focus groups as well.
I mean, I don't know. The problem is if you set your compass by them, it's not right. But if you use it as one aspect of public opinion, they can get you something. But I sort of, anyway, it's just that's where I was.
Were you like in a shadow treasury task force then?
Well, I was waiting for Gordon.
Yeah, so you're watching the budget and...
Yeah, I'm trying to remember now whether it's a false memory syndrome, whether we actually watched the news about the budget, or whether we watched the budget. Because did we really make people sit through an hour? I mean, of like, you know, dirge. Maybe we did. I think we might well have done, actually. But, I mean, Philip was a really fun person to go to these things with.
You can think of no one more fun to watch the budget with.
So then there was Gordon's first budget, which was July 1997.
What do you remember about that?
Actually, what I remember about that, the thing I remember most of all, is there was a very strange institution, which I think may still exist, and this obviously was an autumn statement, the Hunt thing, called the Chancellor's Budget Broadcast. And it was this absolute nightmare doing this with the BBC, because basically there was a rule that you were only allowed four graphics or something. And it was all unbelievably complicated. And it was always, the BBC's basic view was it needed to be as boring as possible.
So was it like a party political broadcast?
Yes, but it's just sort of an address to the nation. I don't know, maybe it still exists. I don't know whether it still exists. And the BBC hated it and I think wanted to get rid of it. And we decided that the easiest thing to do was rather than make Gordon do it after the budget, we'd do it before the budget. And so he began this broadcast by saying, when I walked, because he decided to walk, when I walked from the Treasury to deliver this budget, it wasn't with the battered, I can always remember the words, wasn't with the battered old red box of the past. It was with a red box made by apprentices, I think possibly in his constituency. So it was all very nice. One slightly unfortunate thing happened, though, which is after he recorded the broadcast, for reasons that I can't remember whether to do with the weather or security, he decided not to walk, but he got in a car. I thought nothing of this until I suddenly realised, after he sat down the budget, oh dear, we're about to broadcast that he walked from the thing. And so basically I was like, right at the BBC, and I said, look, I'm really sorry, but we're going to have to cut that beginning. And they were like, well, it's too late, you can't do that. And I said, no, honestly, we're definitely going to have to change the beginning. And I think we did. I think we managed to sort of cut out the sentence about him having walked. So that is the main thing I remember about that budget. I mean, it was obviously a big deal. The Labour Chancellor hadn't delivered a budget for 18 years or something. So then I remember that. And then obviously I remember all the fiscal events after that, with Gordon.
The first year you were in the Treasury, did you all have your photo taken with the red box?
The one made by the apprentices.
Because possibly. Now in an age of camera phones, everybody in that office would be posing for a funny picture with it.
I bet
there is no picture of 27-year-old you holding up that red box.
No, I think there are. I think Ed Ball's got some pictures taken at one point. But, I mean, it was like a thing to get pictures taken.
Mm.
Today I would have done a selfie with Gordon.
Yeah, whereas somebody would have had to think to bring a camera in. Or you'd have to do a Rishi Sunak and have a photographer taking stage shots.
The thing I remember most of all, Gordon was just obsessively write all of his words of these budget speeches. I mean, I think, to be fair, maybe other all chancellors do, but he was just, he cared a lot about the words. A people's budget, I think he called it a people's budget for Britain's future.
Did anything of yours make it into that first budget?
It was a team effort.
But
what do you mean of mine?
Well, I don't know. You know, like for example, independence of the Bank of England was completely down to Ed Balls. It was entirely him, from what I understand. Was there anything like that of yours?
I can't really remember. If I'm honest, I don't remember that much about the first budget. I remember we put money into health and education. That's the main thing that I remember.
What have you noticed over your career about, like, is there a type of person who keeps a diary versus a type that doesn't? See, like a Tony Benn or an Alistair Campbell, or they keep these.
I wish
very
I kept a diary.
But it's a personality type, isn't it? You're either a diarist or you're not. Nobody starts one like that at the age of 56, do they? For example,
I'm not 56.
I was
actually
just looking an age out there. I know you know when.
Why not use my actual age?
I can't remember how old you are.
Okay, 53. But 53. But I mean, you know, you can sort of. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, I'm still sort of reeling, really. I mean, honestly, I'm sadly. Anyway, the thing I noticed about the Hunt thing, we'll go on to the Baltics in a second. We used to, I was quite shocked about this. We were very careful not, and this is why I know it wasn't a budget, it was an autumn statement, but we did not do explicit party politics in the speech, because the speech was sort of a Treasury production. And that's all gone out the window. And basically, there's quite a lot that's gone out of the window. The first budget that Gordon delivered, he appeared in the Financial Times, there was going to be a five-year deficit reduction plan. This was so shocking that this was in the newspapers that an emergency question was asked, and that was in the days when these emergency questions were not granted, before the budget.
Right.
Peter Lilly, who was the Shadow Chancellor, got an emergency question. I mean, your budget is sort of leaked, and, you know, Hugh Dalton famously resigned because he told somebody going into the budget that beer would go up or down or something, and it appeared in the Evening Standard. I'm not even sure it appeared before he delivered it. But, I mean, now it's like it's all... And the second thing I was going to say is that I've nearly noticed with Hunt that he used it to attack the Labour Party. The idea that you'd have had a sort of... We used to have to say this thing, which is, Gordon would say, I've had representations from, and he'd sort of say a Tory policy. But you could never say something specifically about his opponents, or at least we thought you couldn't.
So that wasn't just because you were this new government that had come in on a landslide. That was the precedent, even leading up to 97.
Yeah, you didn't use the financial statement to explicitly talk about your opponents. You could sort of implicitly talk about them.
And did that change during the Labour years, or is that something that's
changed? Well, I just think maybe it's just the convention. I just think a lot of these conventions have gone out of the window.
And what about this pre-briefing stuff? Because I don't feel a compulsion to watch the Autumn Statement.
Because you know it all.
Like, yeah, because it's always been like...
Almost all of it, yeah.
Because I miss that. I miss it being like an Apple event where Steve Jobs would say, oh, and just one more thing. Those things always felt like a magician revealing.
The thing is, though, it's all sort of slight. You know, as I'm saying this, I sort of feel slightly like an old fogey, because who cares about all of that, really?
Well, when did it even start being an autumn statement and a budget? Because,
well, that was our fault, because we introduced. Actually, there was an autumn statement before, but then we introduced something called the pre-budget report and the budget. The autumn statement was the spending, once a year spending, and the budget was the tax measures. Clark integrated the two of them into a unified budget and spending review. We then introduced a three-year spending review, which sort of slightly confused the picture in some ways, and a pre-budget report was foreshadowing the budget. Then they got rid of the pre-budget report, and then they sort of brought it back. I mean, it's two fiscal events a year. By law...
It's the children I feel sorry for, because I used to hate that day when the children's programmes would be shunted onto BBC Two. It was probably your favourite day of the year as a kid.
Well, I've told you that my first political memory is play school being cancelled was Harold Wilson resigned.
Yes, you have told me that, yeah.
But anyway, I don't quite know how many of these I've been to, but I've been to quite a lot. And I had to respond to a whole number of them, actually. Osborne's.
And when you're doing that, you've had the numbers for how long? Day before?
You don't get anything. No, you don't get anything.
What, you genuinely have to do it on the hoof?
Yeah. You do have to do it on the hoof.
So do you game all the possibilities?
Yes, you do. And Rachel Reeves, who replied to the Autumn Statement Business Novel Budget, did incredibly well for us.
I'd imagine that would be nerve-wracking, but I imagine that would be not one of your worst things to have to do in Parliament. I think you're quite fleet of foot in that. You're quite good like that, right?
Sometimes they went better and sometimes they went worse. I mean, it's sort of... I feel, if I'm absolutely honest, that even in the time I've been there, since I was leader Parliament, people pay less attention to Parliament than they did, even on a day like the budget. I mean, okay, they pay attention to the speech and they pay attention to Rachel's reply. But I'm very struck when I do. So I recently did the King's Speech debate. Now, here it was a Thursday, but Parliament just is less. I think it's odd because there was 24-hour news when I was leader and all of that. But Parliament just mattered more.
Yeah, but there's 24-hour news, but what there wasn't...
Well, social media.
Yeah, social media. And I think people are just happy to get the bullet points on social media, so they don't sit through watching Parliament in the same way. So the kind of theatrics of the debate don't matter as much as they used to.
I mean, the theatrics really... You know, I'm sort of... It's interesting that I'm from the sort of... Maybe I'm the sort of bridge to the Gordon... Tony generation, who took parliamentary speeches incredibly seriously.
Well, that shows. But you know, when you make on a speech.
Well,
but did you not think it's that if you did a good job of a speech in Parliament, it would be an unbroken way of speaking almost directly to the public, rather than if you go on Newsnight and you can't get a sentence out.
But I'm not sure. Even in the last 20 years, an unbroken speech in Parliament got that much. I don't know. I wonder if it's what's happened is that politicians have sort of adapted to the reality that there was a sort of generation of politicians who, for whom Parliament had mattered. I don't know.
It's interesting how much the public can perceive the House of Commons as the job.
There could be
outrage if they see an empty chamber.
I think that's different. Well,
I don't know. I think a grasp of what politicians are doing all day still eludes a lot of people, when in actual fact, it's not the substance of your job, is it?
I also find it's quite weird. I mean, maybe this is me, but I have these kind of... I just can remember quite a lot of the House of Commons speeches that I've seen by Gordon, by Tony, by... sort of others, and you just sort of do have a kind of memory bank of these things. Blair did one on Europe, and of course Europe was nightmare for Major. I remember him doing it. I remember it was superb because he had these five different questions for Major about whether he agreed with different people, and the last one was, does he agree with himself? Because it was like a thing that Major had said quite relatively recently. And I remember it was just some absolutely devastating. I'm sounding very fogyish.
But do you think there are MPs who are maybe the most recent intake who have that feeling about speeches they've heard in the past 3 or 4 years?
Less, I think. I mean, obviously the pandemic was, you know, meant it was a very socially distanced parliament and all of that. But I think it's a sort of secular trend. I think making an argument in parliament does still matter.
Have you ever had your mind changed on anything by a well-constructed argument in Parliament?
Well, from someone...
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Have you ever been sat there holding one position in your brain and then you've
heard somebody... I think it's not that, but I think you hear other arguments people make and you think, well, that's a really good argument. I will add that to the arguments I make, or I'll add it to the arguments I need to answer.
Right.
I think it's more that. I don't think you'd sort of then go in and just sort of completely change your mind.
But then it is theatrics.
Sorry to sound inflexible.
But
it's making a case, I think.
But to whom? People who've already made their minds up. Like, there's no jury to be persuaded. So, to some extent...
Well, the jury is partly your own side and partly...
But you've just said that you've never had your mind changed by an argument. But,
I mean... Well, is this Jeremy Paxman or something?
But are you tough enough, Ed?
Right, I think we should move on.
To what extent did you think this Autumn Statement was a Tory party in its death throes, making things difficult for a likely incoming Labour government?
I mean, I tell you, the two things that struck me was, one, it was trying to pretend something, which I think people won't be fooled by. So you can't go and say, you know, taxes are falling, isn't it great? And then it turns out the tax burden's like rising. And I think that would, even as we speak on Wednesday night, that's being sort of found out. And secondly, I personally think it was quite a mistake because I think it looks very tin-eared and out of touch to say the country's turning the corner when your own Office of Budget or the Budget Office of Budget Responsibility says we're having the worst fall in living standards since records began this year. I mean, what does that feel like to be? And you know, tomorrow morning, we're expecting the energy price cap. It's likely to go up, you know, for January. I just think it looks so. I genuinely think it looks just incredibly out of touch.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So what have you got for our chatteroo? What are you thinking about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm thinking about.
Go on.
My wife is an American, and it is Thanksgiving this week. In fact, Thanksgiving tomorrow is...
In God we trust.
In God we trust.
Yeah, that's not Thanksgiving, that's Halloween.
Get on board with the gourd.
How are the gourds?
The gourds are still forming a display on the outside of
goodness.
Our house.
Is there mould, on the gourds?
I would say some of the squashes and pumpkins are starting to rot.
Now's the time to eat them.
Maybe it's time to compost them. But I was reading about Joe Biden. You know that tradition of pardoning the turkey?
Yes.
That ancient tradition.
Yes.
Do you know how ancient it is?
100 years.
1947.
Wasn't that far away.
Do you think that's an odd point in history to have begun this tradition?
Does seem very odd.
Like, in Europe, you've got the birth of welfare states and the NHS here in the wake of the Second World War. In the United States, which has become very rich at that point in history, their big signature move is pardoning a turkey.
Are you a turkey? Oh, no, you don't. What's your vegetarian choice?
Well, I like any kind of nut roasty, anything with a lot of starch and carbohydrates in it. But the two turkeys this year were called Liberty and Belle.
Right.
And there was a bit of a faux pas on Biden's behalf because he tried to drop in a pop culture reference.
Oh, yes. I need to...
Ended up confusing Taylor Britney Swift
Spears
and Britney
Taylor
Spears. Yeah. He made a quip saying... the two turkeys had to work hard and show patience and be willing to travel over 1,000 miles. You could say it's even harder than getting a ticket to the Renaissance tour or Britney's tour. Then he starts kind of having one of his episodes.
Right.
It doesn't make much sense. But I find it a very strange tradition that. It's a bit like Barabbas. It's in the Bible that you're looking at me blankly.
Yeah.
Yeah, Pontius Pilate saying, who should we free?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
It's...
I thought Barabbas might be some pop culture reference to the 1990s that I was too busy working with Gordon Brown on budgets and with Philip Gould in a focus group.
He's supporting Taylor Swift on her current tour. But I think it's a really strange tradition to have a head of state choose which turkey lives and which turkey dies live on television.
I thought he pardoned both of them. Well, I don't think he says, I'm going to kill one of them.
Well, that's the idea, isn't it?
No. You pardon both of them.
You're saying it's not a binary choice.
Well, I think in this case, surely he pardoned both turkeys.
Then he has no respect for this ancient tradition, then.
Well, hang on a minute. No, he's just showing that he's sort of so generous he's pardoning two turkeys. Oh, my goodness. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer pardons a turkey named Dolly Parton.
Oh, so is this happening on a state...
Well, clearly.
On a state-by-state level as well.
The turkey was named Dolly Parton thanks to a statewide contest that received more than 3,900 entries. I mean, this is like Parks and Recreation. Dolly is the second turkey pardoned by Whitmer since she took office. Last year, she pardoned a turkey named Mitch E. Gander.
So if you want your turkey pardoned, the trick is you've got to give it a name, a novelty name.
I think it might happen in a different order than that, presumably. They pick out the turkey and then they give it the name.
But isn't it bad for...
I mean, it's not like there's lots of turkeys with different names all around the country, is it?
You seem very sure of that.
I think you're missing the point here.
Is this bad news for the turkey farmer?
So Liberty, along with Bell.
So they were both pardoned. Okay.
This comes after Chocolate alongside Chip in 2022, thanks to Wikipedia, Peanut Butter and Jelly in 2021.
Ah, I'm now understanding. So I thought he parades two turkeys before the public picks
hang on
one to pardon.
I'm really confused. Because the Trump turkeys also all seem to be alive, but then it also says that it's just really confusing. There's conflicting reports on the turkeys of 2017. I mean, it's just really...
What's that? Conflicting reports and confusion during the Trump presidency?
Alternate turkey.
Why can't he just forgive all turkeys?
Well, there you go. We don't have any traditions like that.
No, we don't. We don't. I do think it's weird that is a tradition invented in living memory, though.
Not in my memory. Well, you mean it'd be better if it was a tradition like 150 years ago?
Yeah, do you not think that just generally about traditions? If they date back from hundreds of years ago, you just think, oh, there's some tradition that weird people from the olden days came up with and we honour it for whatever reason. Whereas it just feels like somebody trying to get a tradition going, like trying to make it happen.
I mean, look,
guys,
you can do a PhD on this. The origins of turkey pardoning by Geoffrey Lloyd. Dr. Geoffrey Lloyd.
So how did it go in 1947? Does Harry Truman...
Well, I don't know, honestly.
Does Harry Truman take to the airwaves, maybe the radio airwaves, maybe the TV, and say, my fellow Americans,
yes,
I am implementing a new tradition in our fine nation. Every year, I and my successors will choose a turkey to be pardoned from death on Thanksgiving. We're going to make this part of our national identity. We're going to take time out of our legislative programme to pardon a turkey. And everyone just gets on board with it straight away.
Well, okay, brief history, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm really sorry, but goes back to 1863.
Oh, well, then it's fine then.
The tradition technically goes back to 1863.
Oh, technically.
When Abraham Lincoln first buried a turkey that was gifted to the White House after it befriended his son.
What?
It was only made official in 1989.
And he didn't like this turkey being friends with his son, so he buried it.
Gosh.
I don't know where I had 1947 from then.
I think we've sort of gone down a rabbit hole.
A turkey hole.
I think we've reached the end of the road on this. I wanted to mention Britain's Loneliest Sheep.
Oh, yes.
I mean, just because we're in the animal kingdom.
Mm.
Do you know about Britain's Loneliest Sheep?
Tell me more.
I think Britain's Loneliest Sheep was found at the bottom of a cliff, I think, but was unable to get away. And then it sort of, I mean, it's quite a very strange social media thing, this, because it got found at the bottom of a cliff, spotted there 2 years later by somebody who'd seen it 2 years earlier, and it hadn't had a good haircut for a long time or whatever. And then it got rescued by some farmers, but then there were some animal people.
Like an animal rights group.
Yeah.
Called Animal Rising.
These
groups never have good names. I have every sympathy. I have every sympathy with their objectives.
And then there seemed to be some kind of sort of whole standoff. I thought it's a very odd story. I mean,
I think the fact that that sheep was down there for 2 years doesn't reflect that well on anyone. Surely it doesn't take 2 years to rescue a sheep.
Well, I don't think you should blame the sheep.
Okay, the sheep is the innocent party.
Well, I don't think that they would have known. I guess they wouldn't have known.
Then how did they know it was there for 2 years then? It seems quite...
Let's just be honest. I really like animal stories. There's been a black rhino born at Chester Zoo today.
No, what have they called it?
Liberty or Bell. I don't know, but it's kind of quite sweet, actually. Do you think it's my age that I feel broody about black rhinos? They've actually got pictures of the birth.
It's like one born every minute, but for black rhinos.
Have you seen, are you watching this video?
No, he's just sent it to me.
Yeah.
Hang on.
I think it's pretty intrusive that they've filmed the birth.
Hang on a second. Oh, look at that.
Yes.
Oh, it initially looks like a bad case of rhino hemorrhoids. Oh, it's very cute.
It is really cute, isn't it?
It's up and going so quickly. So a rhino is just gambolling around within hours of being born then?
Yeah, apparently.
Wow. You think how long it takes a human being? Even now, I'm not that steady on my feet.
15 months pregnancy for the poor rhino mother.
Mm.
Well,
that was very cute, and it's very cute hearing about... Did you say the sheep was called Fiona, or have I subsequently read that?
You've subsequently read that.
Fiona the sheep.
Yeah.
I think the source of conflict is the farmers who rescued her want to put her into a petting zoo, and Animal Rising, the animal rights group, want to get her into a sanctuary.
Why can't everybody just get on?
I know. I have to say, I'm a big animal person. I would be fine in a petting zoo. I'd enjoy being made a spectacle of. I'd enjoy the attention, and having to fend for myself.
Do need a haircut, but you are not you're not a candidate for the petting zoo.
you and my wife are of one mind on the haircut thing.
Yeah, honestly, I think you need a haircut. I need a haircut too, but...
Hey, should we cut each other's hair?
No.
A cheerful chopperoo?
No.
Well,
I think our time is at an end.
I think it is. I'm going to enjoy Sarah's expat Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I must have had Thanksgiving in America a couple of times, and it was quite special.
It is a fun holiday. It is. And tell you what it is as well. It's a nice buffer. That means that Christmas decorations and songs don't start until after Thanksgiving.
I'm trying to get in early on my Christmas presents this year.
Yeah?
I've decided.
Well, it seems to me a lot of thought went into those socks you got me from the shop in the building you work in.
I wasn't quite talking about you, actually. Right.
All right. I'll see you for another cheerful chatteroo next week.
Yes, I guess we will.
Will we?
Probably.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Spring, is that you? Warmer temps mean new Allbirds styles. Meet the Superlight Collection, the lightest ever shoes from Allbirds, now in fresh colors. They've designed must-have travel styles for when you need to jet. The lighter-than-air feel and barely-there fit make these shoes some of the most packable styles ever. That means more comfort and less baggage. Take the Superlight Tree Runner on your next adventure. Its cushy, lightweight foam midsole supports every step, and the extra outsole traction gives you the grip to just go for it. The eucalyptus fiber upper adds next-level breathability to keep you going all day. Plus, the Superlight Tree Runner is comfortable and ready to go right out of the box. So, what can you do in a Superlight shoe? What can't you do is the better question. And, because they're super packable, the real question is, where are you taking them? Experience how Allbirds redefines comfort. Visit Allbirds.com and use code SUPER24 for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's Allbirds.com, code SUPER24.